Welcome to Mint and Burn, the academic analysis of blockchain and other technologies in the decentralized digital economy. I'm your host, Kelsey Nabben, and we are tuning in remotely from the RMIT University Blockchain Innovation Hub to bring you expert guests and test frontier ideas. Today, we're talking to Dr. Michael Penneder from the Austrian Institute of Economic Research, alongside distinguished Professor Jason Potts and Dr. Trent McDonald on blockchain and the evolution of money. Thanks for joining me, everyone.
Thank you for having me invited to join.
Now, I must admit that evolutionary economics is not my area of expertise, so I will throw to Trent to kick off the kind of exploration here and open up with some of the research you've been working on.
Okay, so thanks for joining us, Michael. So I've spent the last little bit of time reading some of your work, and I've noticed that your background is broadly in innovation economics and industrial policy, but you've recently made a bit of a foray into monetary theory with your book Schumpeter's Venture Money and a new article on digital money and crypto. So what was it that made you make this turn?
Yeah, that's indeed a good question to start with. Actually, my research background is somewhat oddly diverse in the sense that I've dealt with many topics from, as you said, industrial economics and innovation research. Though there's one common thread that goes through the different topics, and that is something of an intent to turn to the main themes of Schumpeter's theory of economic development, but investigate them from a contemporary perspective. So in my early research, I've been taking up topics like structural change and aggregate growth. I've dealt with issues on entrepreneurship, on business demography, corporate demography. Then I've turned more and more to topics of entrepreneurial finance, venture capital, which already brought me closer to the recent research. But then also in the past years, and that connects also to the current issues arising, about the tense and intricate relationship between innovation and competition. Now, to explain my motivation, I must say that I do most of my research, and my research is mainly motivated at first hand, so to say, in a self-serving purpose. So if I find something hard to understand or somewhat difficult to understand, and the literature tent doesn't give me the exact answer and exact explanation I was hoping for, then I sometimes start to think on my own and to develop my own ideas. And if then something comes up where I guess that could be of interest and could make an original contribution, then that's the big impulse to go deeper into that. And this is exactly what occurred to me now in this additional step to see more carefully into Schumpeter's monetary theory, because Schumpeter is known for many things, and I've mentioned many aspects of my previous research that are more common fields. He is less acknowledged for his contributions to monetary theory, and that has various reasons, in part because it was never completed, because it was at his time somewhat in the shadow of other contributions that were more prominent and more successful in attracting much followership in terms of modeling strategies and so on. But I found that there were particular pieces of his monetary theory that are becoming more and more relevant now with digitization. And that's the main reason why I found it worthwhile to dig into that and see that actually digitization now brings to the fore many of the aspects that distinguish Schumpeter's monetary theory or the monetary side of his theory of economic development from what is, let's say, the mainstream monetary theories at hand.
So can I ask in this sense, so just for our listeners who might not be tuned into this, so Joseph Schumpeter is one of the greatest economists of the modern era. It was sort of he and John Maynard Keynes were the two sort of major figures in the mid 20th century with different visions of the nature of capitalism. And Schumpeter's famous, Schumpeter's core argument was this idea to focus on economic dynamics and the role of the entrepreneur and of economic change and of innovation and technology as the main way to understand not just the nature of modern economic systems, but the way in which they change. And the key insight that he, also one of the key insights he had was around this distinction between entrepreneurship and finance. That the entrepreneur is the prime mover, the prime agent in the economic system. And you've written, Michael, I mean, a lot about the role of finance in that distinction, that there's that any new venture requires a separate, distinct role for the financier, for a role of finance to create the capital, the venture capital to enable innovation to take place. Now, a lot of that is reasonably well known. What I did not know at all was the monetary side of this, as you were just describing before. Can you just help us understand a little bit how, if those two stories are connected, this sort of macro theory of money as an evolving technology, evolving out of credit? I was fascinated by the article you wrote in the Journal of Evolutionary Economics on that, just really exploring this distinction between commodity money and that, and the idea of the entrepreneur and the role of finance. Is that just sort of two distinct Schumpeterian stories, or are they actually different aspects of the same thing?
Yeah, the important point about it is that they are really two sides of the same story, of the same coin. And that was much neglected in the perception of Schumpeter's work, which focused much on the real side, on the entrepreneur, on the innovation. If you think about the idea of creative destruction, most people think of it as new products, new services, displacing old goods and services. If one looks into Schumpeter's theory of development, the main channel for the creative destruction is not this, let's say, trivial or rather simple mechanism. It's a much more sophisticated mechanism that is mainly going through the monetary channel, through the credit channel. So the entrepreneurs who need pre-financing of innovation, so credit defined in broad terms by Schumpeter as any need to pre-finance innovation or new entrepreneurial ventures that cannot be just paid for or financed by the cash flow of past operations. So the cash flow of past operation that would feed the circular economy, the circular flow of let's call it routine operations, of routine activities. But every time something really new, a new entrepreneurial venture is envisioned by the entrepreneurs, who are indeed the drivers of development, those entrepreneurs have a need to get this innovation pre-financed in a logical sense. It could be a big company as well that already has a lot of cash flow from other operations. But then the new operation must be pre-financed by returns from something else, from some other operations, which in the past was at some point innovative and as well had to be pre-financed. So in Schumpeter's conception, which focuses on this novelty, on this innovation and entrepreneurial ventures, every real value-creating business activity in its long chain of evolution, at the very beginning, must rest on some sort of pre-financing. This gives the strong focus on the pre-financing of the financial system on bringing the whole machinery and the whole system of economic development in motion in the first place. So the entrepreneur, let's say on the real side, there can also be entrepreneurs on the financial side, of course, but if you have the entrepreneurs on the real side, who have ideas about new goods, new services, they need a corresponding financial investor or financier who is able to anticipate the vision of the entrepreneur and to trust the vision and to trust that this vision will create additional returns. And so there's a very peculiar or particular tension and relationship between the entrepreneur and the investor that stands at the beginning of the whole processes of economic development. Of course, we are familiar with all those tensions of that have to do with the proper governance in these investor-entrepreneur relationships. And Schumpeter was aware of that too, but somehow the two sides have to come together and manage their relationship to get the process underway. So it's always intricately one, it's part of the same process. I mentioned in the beginning this creative destruction. Now, creative destruction means that the forgiven, let's say, given supply of means of payments or purchasing power that is available in the economy, the entrepreneur comes along with a new idea and innovation, and for that he needs or she needs to be pre-financed by these investors. So the investors create additional money in terms of credit, or the reallocate money from other activities. But theoretically, the more interesting case is where the investor, the banking system, creates new money, issues new money to finance such an investment. Then this new money is not free money, but any new money inevitably raises some inflationary pressures on the economy at large. The entrepreneur who receives the pre-financing has the purchasing power to purchase the means of production to pay for the labor needed for this innovation. But the overall level of prices, even if marginally rising, will bring to the margin, or will bring into difficulties the marginal entrepreneur, that is the ones who are not innovative and already operating at the margin of profitability. And it is this combination of allocating new purchasing power to the innovative entrepreneur on the one hand, and rising prices that bring the non-innovative entrepreneurs to the margin, and ultimately some of them would drop out or reduce their production. And that's the kind of reallocation, reshuffling, that is at the heart of Schumpeter's idea of creative destruction. It is in its essence a monetary phenomenon that's rarely appreciated in the discussion about Schumpeter.
Yeah, that's a really powerful way of looking at it. I mean, I think what's always struck me about that was, and that you've got a kind of macro story, macro monetary story about, you know, increasing the supply of finance, or that there's a kind of that, you know, the ability of the entrepreneur or entrepreneurial actions are fundamentally constrained by the supply of finance, which is a you know, just think, makes you sort of think of the supply of finance as kind of like this fixed supply curve out there that policy might be able to shift or whatever. But I think, I mean, what's kind of incredible, I mean, I've been in I've sort of been a student of Schumpeter for a very long time, and I'd never ever occurred to me to think of money itself as a technology that would shift that supply curve. Although this idea of, you know, we think of industrial technologies and, you know, R&D and innovation and all these things pushing the frontier outwards on all these dimensions, with entrepreneurs as the agents doing that. But I'd always had a mental model in the back of my own head, I think, that was probably very similar to a lot of people, which is this, policy-driven supply constraint on finance that is just there, and it's either, you know, there's things you can do to shift it. But, I mean, what's sort of striking, I mean, and I'm really looking forward to reading your book on this, but you've taken the perspective of really arguing that if you look at this from a long-run historical perspective, it's absolutely clear that money is a technology, that it's a technology that shifts. You know, you have to sort of look at it over a very long period of time to see this clearly. Can you walk us through your view of the sort of, you know, many thousands of years of financial history and how you sort of see that in the context of a sort of Schumpeterian theory of industrial dynamics?
Yes, so this financial side of the innovation process, there are only a few people who really cover that in the literature, and Carlota Perez, of course, was one of them. She had a similar story, that all those industrial revolutions were accompanied by changes and evolution in the financial system. And so the financial system and the monetary system as such are a technology. They are social technology, because there are a lot of consensus needed and political decision needed on the actual design, but they are technology that evolves with the time. To make a short wrap-up on the long history, of course, for a long wrap-up, I would recommend a book. There's a lengthy historical part, the first section on the history of money and the way how monetary theory tried to accommodate and assimilate the changes in the technology of money. To focus on one aspect that pretty much wraps up much of this historical development that is also relevant in the context of digitization, I would see this historical tendency of dematerialization of money. there was Schumpeter's teacher, Friedrich Wieser, was one of the first who put his finger on that observation at a time when the gold standard was was seen as the sound money. The only incarnation of sound money was commodity money, commodity view. And Friedrich Wieser, teacher of Schumpeter, he observed that in the course of history, money has a tendency of dematerialization. And I think that's now my story of it, but even the early debasement of coins, which of course always seen from the perspective of fraud by the government, which it was at that time, and then economists rightly revolted against that. But it was already part of a tendency and the pressure to increase monetary circulation by a sort of dematerialization. Then what you have, you had this invention of paper money in China early on, which was, of course, a big step towards dematerialization. In the Western Hemisphere, where there was a lack of the strong political unified territory that would have been needed for paper currency, for the introduction of paper currencies, in the Western Hemisphere, you had this development of ever more refined credit instruments that were developed in many cases in response to the need of sovereign debt, but also of commercial needs and expanding monetary circulation for merchant and commercial needs. So you have ever more debt instruments, bills of exchange, running cash notes coming up in England and so on, which are part of the process of dematerialization. At that time, we have this famous Ricardo's Ingo plan, which still meant that when banks issued money, they had to make it convertible and to specie if required. So there was that was a true technological breakthrough, the idea of an economist, and then it was very influential and applied in practice to make circulation much more flexible in terms of paper money, but to keep it grounded and anchored in the provision of specie. But then, of course, changed again after Bretton Woods, when fiat money became the common thing economists use and do. So before, there was over many years continuing tensions whether one is on or off gold and series of crises, inflationary episodes, deflationary episodes, and so on. But since the 1970s, fiat money has become more or less the common practice, which is, of course, meaning that dematerialization occurred ever more strongly. And now I think digitization is, in a way, the ultimate next step in that evolution, in the dematerialization of money. So cryptocurrencies, and we talk about central bank digital currencies and so on, there's a certain logic. If one takes the long-term historical view, there's a certain logic in the process that gives one somewhat more confidence about how these new developments will further come up.
Okay, that's a really helpful bridge. Trent, can you help us connect this theory to cryptocurrency and what's happening in the blockchain economy now?
Sure. So obviously we've got the evolution of digital currencies, crypto coins, Bitcoin and whatnot. We're also seeing a lot of buzz now talk about central bank digital currencies. I suppose what I'd like to ask Michael is, we often talk about money in terms of the three functions of money, right? As a unit of account, as a medium of exchange, and a liquid source of a store of value. So, getting into this evolution of digital money, do you think that all three of those functions are still important today, or is this evolution starting to change the way we actually look at and define what money is?
I think the functions are still relevant today, but they are somehow somehow transformed and somehow absorbed. And I think this is one of the theses in the paper that was published in the Journal of Evolutionary Economics, is that Schumpeter's main conception of money as a social technology of account, that is the function, the standard of value, is increasingly gaining in importance and coming to the fore relative to those functions that had attracted much of the attention in the past monetary literature. So it's mostly the function of money as a medium of exchange. We know that from Karl Menger's theory of money, the utmost saleability of the medium of exchange is what drives the success of the spontaneous order of the monetary system converging, for example, on specie, on these intrinsic advantages of certain commodities. That's losing somewhat in importance relative to this unit of account function in the digital world, I would say. The other thing I'm not sure about is, of course, the function of money as a liquid store of value. So that's something that has much to do with the high volatility we find in cryptocurrencies. That puts, of course, much question marks from that perspective. So I think that function is still important and will also be one of the cases in this competition between different cryptocurrencies. And it already is important in the design. So if we take Bitcoin's intention to emulate gold in a way, then of course the intention is to have a currency that is a liquid but very good store of value, that preserves the value over time by making the supply of that money extremely, extremely scarce in the long run. So I think that is still relevant. But the interesting new aspect, and that's what we bring up in the book, which is co-authored with Andreas Resch from the Vienna University of Economics and Business Administration. So the different aspect is this vision Schumpeter had, and I think it went nowhere noticed in any of the literature. I was surprised too when I reread it. I had certainly read it earlier times and not take notice of it. Is that Schumpeter already envisioned the most fundamental function of money to be the idea of a universal general account relationship. So to say that he was thinking about what is dependent on the particular type of economic system, like capitalist or socialist systems, and what are those functions that any kind of system that tries to organize and tries to run the economic relationships has to provide at least. Then he comes up with the idea that the most fundamental relationship is the universal account. And at his time, of course, he had no idea of a technical realization for that. So it was not a prediction and it was not a utopia. It was just a logical conclusion of what trying to explain what money is in the terms. So that was, of course, the idea of a general ledger at a time when, of course, this digital a revolution was not anticipated at all, but just as a logical conclusion of what he considered the driving forces in the evolution of money. And that's exactly where we are at the moment with this digital money forms of the various kinds. Now, of course, if we now speak of cryptocurrencies, we have this distributed ledger technology as the core technological innovation, which is something that Schumpeter did not anticipate in that way. So distributed ledger gives an entirely new dimension to this, because it means that the general ledger that Schumpeter thought of is the kind of logical conclusion of the evolution of money. With the distributed ledger technology, every participant, at least in the decentralized system, can hold the actual and complete general ledger. So every participant in the system has a hold on the general ledger in its actual form. And that's, of course, a very revolutionary idea that economists still have to cope with and think about its implications. Of course, we now know that this is very resource intensive and expensive, and the alternative forms of permission systems. But still then, you have a distributed ledger technology where all the participant, the permissioned participants, permissioned nodes, have access to the overall ledger. And this general ledger, the fact that it's distributed is of course a technical feature, in the sense that this is what guarantees or shall guarantee the integrity of the accounts. Because if in the system every participant holds the complete ledger, the general ledger, then any individual error, any individual fault, fraud, whatever, is easily detected. So it's this inbuilt enormous redundancy, which is meant to safeguard the integrity of accounts. And the integrity of accounts is the one thing that really matters for each of the three money functions that you asked from the beginning. So to be a meaningful medium of exchange, you need to avoid its double spending. You need to preserve its value. And so the accounts, the integrity of the accounts is the basis for all the other functions. And in that sense, it is this social technology of account version of money that gets a high importance now, I think.
Michael, can I just dig into this a bit? Because you've said a number of quite remarkable things that I think deserve to be better known. So first is this idea of a social technology of account. Now, I interpret that as the sort of Mengerian story of the emergence of money in a kind of way where whatever is the most general liquid commodity ends up being the money that we use. So there's an evolutionary emergence story of that's what is meant by social technology of account. Is that your understanding of what that concept means?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's exactly one of the reasons why I think that Schumpeter now is so valuable in this situation, because you hardly find an economist who combines a deep knowledge of technological change
with deep knowledge
of industrial organization and then the phenomenology of money. So that's a unique constellation to deal with these challenges now.
So that's the sort of the Mengerian evolution of money story as told by Schumpeter, sort of arguing that that's a continuous evolutionary process of thinking of money as a technology. The next thing, just to note, what sort of struck me as interesting about that was this idea that this sort of and how that then relates to trustlessness, or that this idea of having a having sort of an algorithmic process that's starting to be the selection force that's shaping what will work on that. But okay, so there's that. The other thing that I think is just absolutely remarkable is if you work backwards from Bitcoin and Satoshi Nakamoto, and you look at the sort of the literature that he, she, or they was citing or being referenced by, and almost everyone points immediately to Hayek and goes, Hayek, the private money, that's the economist that was the forerunner of my thinking. And a lot of the Nick Szabo and Dai Wei and all of the sort of precursors to Bitcoin all also pointed to Hayek's private money. But your argument is actually that's not the key concept. It's not the private ordering of a private currency. What the key sort of forerunner of, or the precursor of that idea, the most general idea, is this idea of a general ledger. And I think that's right. That is actually the concept that is most that seems to lead directly into the key insight of what a cryptocurrency or the Bitcoin blockchain is actually doing, is a universal, transparent, and uncensorable general ledger. Now it's turned out that the proof of work mechanism enables that general ledger to be a distributed ledger. But from an economic perspective, the real breakthrough there is this idea of a general ledger as money, rather than a commodity money or a private money. Is that the argument that you're making, that it's actually Schumpeter's general ledger is the big key sort of forerunner?
That's definitely the argument I'm making. I would somewhat have a different sequence of sorting the arguments, in the sense that Schumpeter was in that sense jumping ahead by seeking a logical conclusion to the function of money, what money is, and he had this trust in the evolutionary process to bring up and to bring out the basic logical theoretical function, so to say, in the course of time. So he was jumping ahead in a way, whereas Hayek's idea came up in the 1970s after a period of high inflation, and then he had this idea of private monies that can compete if for the Polish is a legal tender. And I think in the 1970s, it was not had not much impact in the, certainly not among economists, but now these cryptocurrencies, they have really shown that this is technically feasible. So Hayek's idea was on the one side proven logically sound and correct. It's conceivable to have it that way. On the other hand, I disagree a bit with Hayek's view. I think Hayek has not taken the one step further, which is, of course, now much easier now in the age when we have all these digital platforms and the growing power of the big big tech companies with all their network effects, indirect and direct network externalities that help them and give us a feeling and an impression that these private monies, in the end, at least that's my impression shared, I think, by many, that these private monies will not forever remain or stay contestable in the sense that the Thai could have thought of. I think contestability is something that Schumpeter always had in his mind as well, that the system has certain tendency towards concentration so that the big players in the end may dominate, not just because they offer the best money, which would be Hayek's argument, if they offer the best money in the sense of, in his sense, practically only reasoned in terms of the store of value function. So people will choose the money which keeps the value store the value in liquid form. But with the threat of a few private currencies in the end dominating and extending the dominance of the big tech platforms also to the area, to the monetary system, is something that is by many conceived a rather realistic threat or a realistic outcome in the end. And that's why I think the next logical step in this evolution will be again more towards this, towards a more central and more, so in the sense, a more social technology that is designed by political decisions and of course needs social institutions that can cope with it and that again bring back the need for trust in the social institutions in the sense that governments will and need to preserve their sovereignty over the general unit of account. That's a core issue what central banks now realized in the past years, and it took some time for them to see that there is danger that the sovereignty over the unit of account can be lost to, let's say, private big tech partnering up with all kinds of other payment system, credit cards, etc. And if they lose control of that, it's hard to imagine, or one can hardly imagine what goes away with it, or what societies lose with it in terms of sovereignty and ability to be resilient to shocks, etc.
So how do you see you've just indicated that you're worried about that, but what do you think is a likely scenario in terms of CBDCs and if we think of stable coins as basically private digital monies that are units of account pegged to a fiat currency, and CBDCs as the government version of the same thing with extra surveillance built into it, or an ability to see the general ledger underneath. Do you have a sense of what the future could look like? Is this just a set of branching possibilities and we have no idea, or is there inevitability here?
There are a few, actually very few, but there are some authors who have thought into that also deeply, and I agree with some of them. So, for example, Markus Brunemeyer, and others, they have this view that you will have, so you can have several digital monies in a sense. So there can be coexistence of central bank digital currencies and private crypto coins of various sorts. The crucial thing to keep an eye on and to guard from the public side is the sovereignty over the unit of account. So which means that the private monies that in the end are convertible into these public monies, they are linked to the overall system and still have the possibility of monetary policy to operate and keep the room for maneuvering in times of crisis to keep a certain function of lend of last resort, etc., which is not guaranteed with the private system. On the other hand, you do not have to impede innovation in all those many different fields where crypto coins are introduced for specific purposes, and all these fintech innovations that you do not want to impede just in order to preserve the dominance of central banks, to put it that way. So one can distinguish between digital monies seeking different advantages for specific purposes with particular communities in the virtual sphere, where there will be a lot of innovation going on and that will continue, I think. But the crucial part where the, so to say, the system strikes back and will maintain its control and will jump in, and it did already announce so in the past years, and that has already had an impact on the developments in the recent 1 or 2 years, to announce regulations, etc., is the sovereignty over the unit of account. And maybe that's the next step. Maybe if nevertheless the challenge by the private cryptocurrencies is strong enough, and the main challenge comes from the global reach of some of them. So if the Diem, former called Libra, if the initial ambition was to be somewhat of a global currency, a worldwide currency, that is a challenge that might in the end also induce different central bank digital currencies to cooperate in the sense of setting up an efficient global payment system where these different national digital currencies can cooperate and work together. So it could, in this challenge between private contestants and the public response, there could in the end be something very good that comes up that increases the efficiency of international transactions, for example, and also accessibility in more remote areas and areas with less reliable government institutions.
Can I ask what you're seeing in Europe at the moment on this, in terms of, you know, what's the ECB doing in relation to this? I mean, we're seeing China doing some quite, you know, bold or alarming things, depending on your perspective. In Australia, our Reserve Bank is just confused and has put out a number of rather wishy-washy issues paper. But I think a lot of places, including Australia, are really just waiting to see what the big players do. And my sense of this is that the European Central Bank has been thinking about this the longest. I mean, do you have a perspective on that, or in terms of what they're doing?
Yeah, I'm not sure whether I have enough inside knowledge to really give an authoritative account, but my observation from a bit outside, as I'm not part of this central bank, there are so many communities around the central banks with people dealing with these topics for longer. But my observation is that in Europe, many central banks for a long time shied away from the topic, but still were very curious. That they had a lot of seminar series and a lot of discussion going on the topic. But at least on the official side, for long, they tried to somewhat reduce the issue by saying, well, Bitcoin and these things, they are not really money. And yeah, I think technically they are money. In practice, because of the high volatility, there's good reason to say it's not really money, or it doesn't work well as a means of transactions, etc. But they somewhat put it on the side. But beneath the official level, there already was a lot going on in the sense that national banks were concerned and had a lot of discussion going on. And now the change that came, and I assume that the major impulse was with the announcement of Libra at the time, of this global currency, that there really was the feeling or the experience that there's something big going on and they might miss on it. And now the European Central Bank, also in cooperation with the European Commission, are now much more openly embracing the idea that they have to come up with their own solutions to the certain demands that these private solutions show to exist. And so I think the discussion is now much more serious. It's still in a very early phase, so it's about having some experimental runs and research projects going on. But the big step was a more a clear awareness and commitment to face the issue.
Back to your previous response, it's really interesting that you've presented kind of three currencies moving forward. So one is a sort of digital CBDC model, central bank digital currency. One is the kind of corporate platform, and then the other is this multitude of sort of cryptocurrency communities. The ideas of Hayek and currency competition and Austrian economics sort of heavily influenced some of the cypherpunks in the 90s discourse in the lead up to the creation of Bitcoin. How do you think this currency competition results for people? So what's the kind of outcome, you know, on the ground of these sort of alternative and competing realities?
Yeah, good and difficult question. I think one of the outcomes is that these alternative monies put much pressure and also enforce discipline with government monies or public central bank monies. So it could be positive impact on people in practice that governments that would be induced to give in to incentives for inflation for using inflation to get away with some of the problems will have it more difficult than before, because if you do not completely lock down the economy and the internet connections, then people have options to migrate to other means of payment, at least in the virtual sphere, and that so there is an additional discipline on government that will mainly have an impact on those people living in countries where the government institutions do not work well. On the other hand, in those economies where economic development is high and where, in principle, the public institutions are trusted to a reasonable degree, I think the main benefits will come in terms of lower transaction costs. So you will have there are a lot of efficiency gains that are possible. In that way, there is, however, the big question about bank disintermediation. That's not solved. There are different options how such central bank digital currencies can be designed that could have different impacts on bank disintermediation. And here, it's not clear what the outcome will be, because there are, of course, big advantages for commercial bank lending in terms of the informational advantage of, especially when you have close relationships to your creditors. On the other hand, centralized solutions can benefit enormously from all kinds of developments in artificial intelligence and machine learning and so on. And I don't know how this match will end up. But so far, both the Bank of China, People's Bank of China, and the ECB have always mentioned and emphasized that they do not want to go into this area, which is not their field of expertise, and do not go into the commercial lending business. And so they want to design their currencies in a way that leaves enough room for commercial banking and hence for the credit system to pertain. And if I go back to the Schumpeter story, then the banking system is extremely important, because this credit by fractional reserves is the kind of money ligament that keeps the system elastic and strong if it works well as well. So I like this metaphor of Schumpeter of the credit system as a ligament, which means the tissue that holds together the bones in the body, which has to be elastic to some extent, as great has to be, but of course it cannot be weak. If it's too weak, if it's not strong enough, if not firm enough, then the system would also break.
Right. So I think we've travelled through a nice path, a bit of a story here. So starting with Schumpeter and his entrepreneur and the need for pre-finance and how that impacts money, and you mentioned that the ECB has been taking a bit of a wait-and-see approach when it comes to developing and looking at central bank digital currencies. And, I think in general in the economics profession, you know, some, there's been quite a bit of skepticism about, you know, the, just how relevant these technologies are and what impact they'll have. It seems to have taken the economics profession a little bit by surprise. You know, we're still 10 years in, at least 10 years into cryptocurrency and blockchain technology, and people are just starting to become more and more interested. So why do you think that is? I read that you mentioned that you thought that the advent of digital currencies took economists by surprise. So do you think that's just because the technology came out of a computer science background, or is it something about the discipline of economics that's caused that?
Yeah, that brings us back to the first question you raised in the beginning. What was motivating my research on the issue? I indeed thought it very surprising and significant that economists were not prepared for these developments. And I think the main explanation is that they have accommodated with the basics of monetary theory much earlier and did not really try to reopen the old questions about what's called the phenomenology of money. So what's the essence, what's the basic, real, essential basic function of money? That was something that early economists were intensively discussing, and that was settled for the past century or so. And digitization now brings back exactly this question. And the reason why it brings that back is because money is a social technology which evolves over time. And I think that this has been a step that economists, by and large, had difficulties to assimilate with or to take up. And that's an important thing to acknowledge from the economist side, that there are things going on in the world while we had our models, and the models have been improved and became even more sophisticated. But they rested on the same basic assumptions, because it was not really part of the agenda to think about how money itself changes over time because of these changing technologies. So in a way, it's a call for an evolutionary perspective applied also in this monetary sphere, which I was missing, and which brought me, of course, again back to Schumpeter in this regard.
I couldn't agree more with that sentiment. I think that's absolutely right.
Such a fascinating discussion, and I've definitely learned a lot and have a lot of links, I guess, for myself and our listeners to follow. Thank you so much, Dr. Michael Penada, Jason Potts, and Trent McDonald, and thank you to our audience for this episode of Mint and Burn. You can check out the show notes and get in touch if you have ideas or feedback on the podcast. Visit rmitblockchain.io. And Michael, what's the best way for people to find you if they want to find out more about this topic?
I'm still a bit old-fashioned in maintaining my personal homepage, but I've also started to join a social community on Twitter. So any new developments, news, especially on the topic, I will forward there. So I have a Twitter account, and I'm happy for anyone to follow.
Thank you so much to our guest for this episode on blockchain and the evolution of money, Dr. Michael Penada, as well as my colleagues, distinguished Professor Jason Potts and Dr. Trent McDonald. You can check out the show notes and get in touch at rmitblockchain.io.